Hello. Welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. Today is Monday, May 23rd. This is episode 15. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with Scott Nelson. Good evening, Scott.
Good evening, Matt.
New date, new time. Same podcast. Same cup of coffee. So, all good there.
Only decaf. We must confess it's decaf because it's nice.
And I'm old.
Needs sleep.
So I would like to declare today is officially the start of summer because I rode my motorcycle for the first time today.
All right.
I mean, I'm sure that other people have their own official declaration for the beginning of summer. But for me, it's when I finally get the motorcycle out of the garage and ride it around. And I did that today.
Nice. It was a beautiful day for it.
Yeah, right up until it rained, but
it was a little windy.
Yeah, that's part of being, you know, in the wind, as they say. So yeah, that was good. All right, so this week's topic is The Millionaire Next Door by Thomas J. Stanley and William D. Danko. It's book report time. So we have now both read this book. I have read it twice. I once read this many moons ago, probably, I don't know, the year 2000 or thereabouts. And this book is basically about these two guys who started studying who are actually the affluent people in America. And how do they behave? And when they started, they thought this would be relatively easy, but of course the truth is stranger than fiction. This was very important and powerful book for me many moons ago when I first read it. Its message is still valuable and important today. But I don't think its message is as hidden today as it was 15 years ago, because there are lots of early retirement sorts of blogs on the internet, like Mr. Money Mustache or Thrifty Gal or you name it, you can find it, which in their own way have a similar message to what I think the average reader takes away out of here. But these guys are empirical data-based, you know, researchers, right? And they're presenting their findings based on their evidence, not just their own personal individual experience like so many bloggers are. So I, from that perspective, I think it's powerful, especially if you think some of these blogs are, you know, well, it worked for you, but it won't work for anybody else, right?
Mm-hmm.
This whole book is, you know, drawing statistical conclusions from, hey, it worked for all of these people, and it can work for you. So what did you think? This is your first time reading this book.
Yeah, from like an information standpoint, it was very interesting. It's not really like a self-help book. It's not an advice book, so to speak. It's an informational book. It's about understanding who's rich and how they got there.
Right.
Which is very interesting. I didn't really understand that's what it was when I started reading it. I thought it was going to be more instructional.
Yeah, there's no Suze Orman in this at all.
No. And, you know, like you said, I mean, the late 90s, early 2000s, there was that surge of, like, financial counseling on mainstream TV.
Yeah.
You know, like Suze Orman and Mad Money. And, you know, it became a pop culture thing to be a better saver, you know.
Right.
So I feel like I'm a little desensitized to that. You're right. Nothing in here really shocked me per se, But it was very interesting, and it did make me think a lot about, you know, what I've accomplished so far in my, you know, financial history.
Yeah.
Which is based on the standards set forth in this book, less than I should have accomplished by this point in.
Yeah, you're under.
In my life. I am a UAW. I am an under.
Under accumulator of wealth.
Under accumulator of wealth. That's it. I'm sure you're a prodigious accumulator of wealth.
I am a. Yes. According to their definition, I am. For my age.
So.
For the moment.
Right. things do change.
Things do change. So. So first, let's start off with what did they define as wealthy? And it was household-based, not individual-based. So they're, you know, it is just easier for them to do away with the difference between is it the husband's money or the wife's money, right? Whatever. It's your household. And it's $1 million of net worth without including the value, the net worth of your primary residence, which is, I think, a really great measure of are you wealthy or not. Because some people have brilliant, beautiful homes. I have several friends with beautiful homes. And some of them are paid off. Some of them are mortgaged to the hilt. It doesn't matter. But if you have a brilliant home, and even if it's paid off, if you think that that somehow makes you wealthy, it doesn't. It just means that you have a great house. And whenever I have this conversation with somebody and they think that it is wrong to exclude the value of your primary residence, it always comes back to, yeah, gotta have some place to live, right? You can live in a $1 million house. You can live in an $8 million condo in New York. You can live in $150,000 house in the suburbs of the Midwest, or you can live in a $20,000 trailer home. I don't care where you want to live, but somewhere you have to live. Jacob Fisker of Extreme Early Retirement has some place he has to live, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an RV, but he has some place he has to live, right? Nobody's going to be a millionaire and homeless and think that that's okay.
Right. So, I mean, the counter argument is I could sell my $1 million house tomorrow and I could buy a $150,000 house and then that would contribute $850,000
to your wealth.
And the answer is exactly.
And if you do that,
then
you can count it.
Right.
But if you've got that $1 million tied up in the roof over your head, it doesn't count.
Because that's kind of a loaded thing. I mean, your house could burn down. The market could turn. You can't sell your house. Like, it doesn't count unless it's in cash in the bank.
Yeah, or
which is a good standard.
In some other marketable security, right? But the so I am a big fan of their basic definition, which is $1 million, not including the value of your home. Once you do that, you know, most of the millionaires in here didn't have any other types of depreciating assets that were worth significant sums of money. Like, they didn't talk about anybody who owned, you know, a $2 million Ferrari or something like that, right? And that made them a millionaire. People who own those, you know, the money that they spend on that is typically such a small percentage of what they're doing anyway. They've just decided to allocate some amount of money for play money, and they use it to buy fancy cars, drive them for a while, sell them, buy some other fancy car, which is fine. So I liked their basic definition of wealth. They talk a lot about the different trials and tribulations they had to find these people and figure out who they are, because they're not the people that you see at the restaurant or, you know, at the mall that look like the millionaires. The basic takeaway from this book is if somebody is living in a fancy house and driving a fancy car and wearing fancy clothes, odds are they've spent all of their money trying to look fancy, as opposed to the people who probably blend in and in fact have accumulated quite a lot of wealth. So, I mean, for the younger version of myself, who was trying to have a fancy car and a fancy house and fancy clothes, that was a powerful statement for me. I don't know. Do you have a...
Yeah, and they spent a lot of time in the book. So, like I said, it's interesting. It's not... A lot of it was not really a great read. And for me, a lot of it was... They spent a lot of time talking about vehicles, about what vehicles people drive, and more so people's vehicle purchasing habits and what that says about, you know, your financial wherewithal in general.
Yeah.
And I think what went on is, you know, they saw this pattern of the vehicle people drove, how they bought those vehicles, and then how that translated into the rest of their lives. And, you know, they thought that was very interesting. And I didn't find it to be that interesting. Do you know the part I'm talking about?
Where yep.
It goes on and on and on about your vehicle purchasing style. Well, whether you're loyal to a dealer, whether you buy new cars, whether you buy used cars. But, I mean, for me, the big takeaway was that most millionaires drive, you know, either domestic cars or less expensive foreign cars. Many of them buy used cars.
Yep.
They keep them for a number of years. They don't lease cars.
Yeah, because they've... the theme comes up again and again. The people that they found for this book that were the wealthy were very good at minding their P's and Q's, right? They ran a very efficient household, right? And they talked about it in cars. They talked about it with clothes. They talked about it with food. They talked about it with all kinds of things that these people did. And they almost did it unconsciously. Like, it wasn't they didn't wake up in the morning and try to figure out how to save another 50 cents at the grocery store. They were just naturally the type of people who intrinsically understood that I'm going to spend the money I need to spend to get something that's good enough for whatever it is, right? For my wardrobe, for the vehicle that gets me to and from my work, and that's it. I'm not going to spend any more. Like, they didn't have a strong need to pull into the parking lot at the office with the fanciest car, right? Or they didn't have a strong need to wear the fanciest clothes in the office. And in fact, a lot of the people in here were, business owners, and their business was some sort of tradesman's business, right? You know, plumber, construction worker, whatever, right? And that's not their uniform. Their uniform is not that of an investment banker, even though they could potentially afford, a $15,000 Rolex and drive to work in a BMW. That's not what they wear, right? It's a Timex and an F-150 because that's what their workers drove and that's what they needed to fit in for their role. And you saw that again and again with they talked about the doctor that made, you know, nearly $500,000 a year and had saved roughly $1 million for retirement, but lived such a fantastic lifestyle that his $1 million of retirement savings, even though it technically made him a millionaire, it made him poor, right? Like he didn't really have a lot of assets because he did not run a very efficient household, right? They spent wild sums of money on clothes and food and trips and gadgets and clothes and cars and everything else that the other people didn't. The other important element to that is it wasn't that these people who were truly wealthy and were running an efficient household, it wasn't that they were living like monks. They always had things for which they enjoyed, right? They had hobbies and things for which they could afford to spend, and it was within their desires to spend seriously above average amounts of money to do whatever hobby or important thing there was for them to do, right? Just because they did not live in a fancy house doesn't mean that they didn't enjoy playing golf at the finest places to play golf. You know, that's another important lesson, right? Being frugal over here lets you not be frugal over there. And sometimes it's hard for people to see that and understand it. You know, they just see, you know, oh, so-and-so can, these rich people around me can spend a lot of money on this thing over here. They must spend lavish sums of money all over their life, which isn't true at all.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. How do you think, like, reading through the behaviors of these people, how did you feel that you compared to them?
Well, some of it was interesting in that not only is it not advice, but it's kind of like anti. It basically, it's saying based upon your current status, you're less likely to be a millionaire because you don't fall into these criteria that many millionaires meet. For instance, they said immigrants or first generation Americans are much more likely to become millionaires because they haven't been conditioned to like a consumerism culture.
Right.
They went as far to make that statement that the longer your family has been in America, the less likely each generation is to become wealthy.
Yeah. Cause your kids are going to grow up watching TV and wanting all of the things that they're bombarded with by appetizers. By advertisements. And so they're not, you know, whatever country you come from, most humans are more or less fundamentally the same. And they want the same shiny stuff that all of the people around them want.
Right.
And here in America, there's a lot of shiny stuff.
Another key takeaway was something like 80% in the 80 percentile of the millionaires are self-employed or business owners of some type.
Yep.
The outliers were the people who are just, you know, salaried wage earners, who become millionaires.
But the same basic premise holds, right? I earn this much. I only spend some significant portion less than that. I save the difference. And there I am.
I can see how it requires a much greater degree of frugality when you have a fixed salary. I guess I feel like they talked about that a lot, even in the final chapters of the book where it was sort of advice, only really the advice was basically become a business owner in a market that targets other wealthy people, essentially.
Yeah.
But they just kind of explore that your earning potential is so much greater as a business owner.
Yes.
You don't have the fixed ceiling on your earning potential that you do as a salaried employee.
No, you have a different set of risks. You know, people view the risks and rewards and the opportunities differently. You know, the upside to being an employee is you get up and go to work and do what they tell you, and you don't have to worry about a lot of that
they
stuff.
Didn't talk about a lot of that either. They did talk about the risk thing. They didn't really talk about the, you know, kind of enjoying your life aspect of being an employee versus an entrepreneur.
And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to each their own, right? The path is possible.
So for me, it's like I can't suddenly become a first-generation immigrant. I could, I guess, become a business owner or self-employed. You know, that's a little bit more of a stretch. So for me personally, the focus is on things like budgeting and financial planning and, you know, those things that they talked about, living frugally.
Yeah.
They really did stress a lot of the people who are wealthy, you know, spend twice as much time per on a weekly or a monthly basis of actual financial planning and budgeting. And it takes time and effort, but not that much time and effort.
No. You know, you spend all that time earning the money. Doesn't hurt you to spend, you know, a wee bit of time managing it effectively.
Right. So for me, as I was reading it, those are the things that more struck a chord that I should work on, and it's the budgeting and planning.
Yeah. My, you know, budgeting and planning and keeping track of money, whatever you want to call it, ebbs and flows. At some points in my life, I'm really good at it. And at other points, it kind of, I don't know, just it gets less interesting. Other more interesting things are going on and it's less interesting to me. So it ebbs and flows. I'm actually probably at a lower point. I should, you know, reading this book reminded me I should stop being lazy and work on that a little bit harder. Maybe that's an opportunity to try something new. Maybe that's another good topic for a podcast, is the different bits of software or methodologies that can be employed to do that stuff. And is that your takeaway? Is that what you're going to try to change going forward? Are you going to make changes?
I think so. You know, I have other things going on in my life right now. You know, I just started a new job after working kind of contract freelance type work for a while. So I have a more steady fixed salaried income. So I think it's a good opportunity to, you know, see if I can maximize what I do with it right off the bat.
Yeah.
I mean, it was interesting there. The other thing that was cool about the book is it's a lot of anecdotes. Mm-hmm. Some of them were obviously contrived to prove a point. A lot of them, I'm sure, came direct from interviews.
Yep.
It was interesting to read about other real people's experiences. And a couple of those were about people who, you know, had a salary of $60,000, you know, or a household income of something like $60,000 for their entire lives and managed to accumulate wealth in excess of $1 million.
Yep.
So I can't say, oh, I only make X thousands of dollars per year. There's no way I can accumulate Y amount of wealth, because it's possible and people do it.
Yeah.
And it's not, they're not eating ramen and living in a, you know, in a woodshed. They're just being very careful.
Yeah. And sometimes it involves thinking about things differently. I once had a friend who, he's in a part of his life where he was kind of stuck, and, you know, he's feeling trapped in his job, and he had a lot of bills, and he was really struggling to try to find a way out of it intellectually first, and then the action could follow. And we were having lunch one day, and we were talking about, you know, money and expenses, and we kind of had this, I don't really want to say heated conversation, but I was kind of challenging him a little bit to give up some of his notions about how he had to spend the money that he had, right? To basically question some of the decisions that he'd made about what was important for him to spend money on versus not. And the net result of it was he agreed to a food challenge for 1 week to eat on $1 a day or less. Because he thought he was totally going to fail and prove me wrong. And in the end, he came out of it, and he did it for 5 days. I think he did it for a work week. And I'm going to forget now, but it worked out to like 97 cents a day or something, right? And he was like, other than the fact that my wife is ready to kill me, like, I could see how if I was willing to like buy in bulk a little bit for some of these things, right? Because he was trying to just buy, like a week's worth of food roughly, right? Which makes it harder. But he's like, I feel like I could get that down like even more, right? And I would eat differently. He's like, but I don't think I would eat worse. He's like, I didn't dislike anything I ate this week. And that really kind of opened his eyes. In the end, he and his wife found Dave Ramsey, and they're doing great now, which is fantastic. But that notion of rethinking some of your default decisions is powerful. And that's what, when I read a book like this, that's what it does for me. It makes me question some of my default choices.
And for me, I feel like I liken that behavior to the don't buy fancy coffee every day,
Unlike the fancy coffee we're drinking right now.
Right. Or eat out one meal less per week. Or that's more of this Susie Orman, like the pop culture type financial advice that I feel like I've been bombarded with in the past. And stuff like that isn't really sustainable for me because I like to go to Starbucks and get an Americano several times a week, and I'm not going to cut that out of my life. You know what I'm saying?
It's part of what makes life worth living.
So I do, do little challenges like that sometimes, right? Like I'm not going to buy any new food until I've eaten everything, that I have in my pantry. Yep. I'm not going to go out to eat until I've, eaten all my leftovers, stuff like that. I don't know that ultimately ends up producing real results for wealth accumulation in my life. So I think my new strategy needs to be something more like I'm going to save X dollars per month, or I'm going to save X percentage of my salary off the top. And then whatever I have to do from a budgeting standpoint to make that happen.
Yeah.
That's what I do. I've never really gone down that path of the proactive, pay myself first approach.
Yeah. That's what I do. I found that to be very powerful. I am able to calculate a single number, right? I calculated a savings rate percentage number. And that to me was powerful. That was a powerful motivator. And so, I did it before tax. Some people say you should do it after tax. It doesn't matter. Right? The number is for you. So I figured out how much money do I make? How much of that gets saved in some way? In a 401k, in a Roth IRA, in just a savings account, in just a brokerage account, whatever, right? Stuff that's saved for retirement, distinct and separate from stuff that's saved until Apple finally updates the damn MacBooks and I can buy another one, right? I mean, because some money you just save because you're going to spend it on something later versus money you save because you intend
to keep it forever.
Yes. And so once I figured out what that number was, it just gave me the clarity of, all of these actions change that number. And so, if you want to start doing things that change that number, is that worth it? Maybe you want to buy a new car. Okay, well, this year or that car payment or however you choose to think about it, whether you're just going to write a check or do whatever you're going to do, right? That's going to impact your ability to save potentially, right? That number might go down, Is that worth it? Is it worth going from 12% to 10% or whatever it is?
Right.
Right. And so that one number for me helps me make mm-hmm. value judgments in times where I sometimes want to, not really spend money frivolously, but, you know, sometimes it's easy to feel like money's burning a hole in your pocket.
Right.
And what you really need, like the thing that will really make your life better, is a Rolex Sea Dweller Deep Sea, for instance.
For instance.
Just to pick a random thing out of the thin air. It won't make your life any better, but it is a very nice watch. So, you know, you gotta...
Right.
That one number yeah. helps me make the value judgment.
So then another thing, and this doesn't come straight out of the book, but it's something that I thought about in order to achieve something that does come out of the book, and that's budgeting. In the past, I've tried budgeting. I never really do a very good job at it, and I never really follow through with it. And I think part of the problem with that is I spend pretty much exclusively on a credit card.
Yep.
Which a lot of people do, you know, even if you're paying off the balance
yep.
month to month. But what that does is I'm never really thinking, oh, I have X dollars in my checking account. That's all I can spend, you know, which is budgeting, you know.
It is a form of budgeting, yeah.
A form of budgeting. Well, and so I feel like I've done myself a disservice of getting in this position where I put everything on a credit card. And then occasionally, you know, you get to the end of the month, need to pay off the credit card bill. Oh, well, I actually don't have that much money in my checking account after I've done, you know, my retirement yep. savings and my all my bills, expenses, whatever. And so then maybe you carry a balance for a month.
So I also spend almost all of my money on a credit card because I find it's easier to keep track of mm-hmm. what I'm spending, right? There are lots of bits of software that can, you know, download all those transactions from American Express or your bank or whatever, right? And if you keep track closely of all the money that you spend, you'll find that you're a creature of habit, right? There's probably 25 places on planet Earth that you spend money. And then you just kind of go in a circle.
Right.
And so once you get that stuff in your software and you get it categorized, you know, coffee, dining, groceries, gas, whatever it is, right? You can start keeping track of that stuff pretty easily, right? That stuff can update every day or every couple of days with almost no effort on your part. And it's fairly easy then to... as opposed to keeping a running total in your head of a checking account balance, you can keep a running total in your head of, man, I've already spent $350 dining out this month. I'm going to go home and have dinner tonight. Right. I'm not going to,
right,
you know, swing by Taco Bell one more time.
Oh. So you're right.
So for the record, Scott just grimaced when I said Taco Bell.
I don't pay attention. For me, like reconciling my credit card statement is going through the transactions and making sure nothing looks out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
I'm not importing it in any kind of software. I'm not categorizing it. I'm not reconciling it with a budget. So if I were to do that while using the credit card, that would solve the problem. I'm just saying the easiest, the scorched earth approach to just having greater visibility to what I'm spending or to prevent myself from overspending would be stop using a credit card. Even if it's just as an experiment.
Yeah. An experiment, I can see it. I usually shy away from scorched earth policies because it's not sustainable.
Right.
Right. Small changes over time, you'll start to, you know, turn the great ship Scott a little bit, you know, away from the shoals of debt into the sea of millionaireism. Right.
And yeah. So,
but it's small changes over time. I've had a couple of different friends that I've counseled over the years. They've, in one way or another, complained about money, and I've encouraged them, just keep track of your money, you know, like to the penny, you know, and I've helped them figure out strategies for it. I'm like, don't worry about budgeting. Don't worry about saying, oh, we can't spend this, we can't spend that. Just keep track of the money exactly and categorize it, right? Every receipt, keep track of it. And I'm telling you, after 2-3 months of not being able to hide from where you spend money, right? You and your spouse, right, are going to look at it, and you're naturally going to change.
But you got to do it.
That's but you got
to
do it.
You got to look at it. You got to commit to it. I don't know if I can do that. I mean, I'm thinking through this, and I'm like, it would be easier to just withdraw cash, you know, yeah, for my budget, right? Say, here is my food budget. Put it in an envelope, and when I go to the grocery store, I pay out of that.
And there's envelope. There's the envelopes budget, right? I mean, right? That's totally a thing, right?
For I mean, everyone. I think that's what I might have to do to start down the path of doing it, because I just don't know if, I mean.
So clearly we need to talk about various budgeting strategies. I mean, I'm willing to support you, Scott, in whatever it is that you want to do. But as a software engineer, if you're down to using envelopes and cash, I feel like the internet has failed you.
I just, you know, I've tried Mint in the past, and I've used Microsoft Money or Quicken or whatever, yeah, and I just never commit to it for more than a couple of months, like, because it's a pain in the butt. And that's a key takeaway from the book that I already mentioned, was you have to invest some time in budgeting and planning. And all the people who are millionaires do.
Yep. But they don't invest a lot of time.
No.
Like, you know, what did they say? Like 2-3 hours a month.
Right. And it ended up being twice as much as people who live paycheck to paycheck, essentially.
Yeah. But their level of worry through the month about money was probably much zero. Much lower.
Yeah.
I know that when I'm really on top of my budget and stuff, my concerns for money are very low. My concerns for money are not super high at the moment, but it's even lower, right? Mm-hmm. You just know. Sometimes people ask me weird questions, right? Like, you know, why do you do this and why don't you do that? I'm like, well, you know, I do this and, you know, this costs me, you know, $950 a year. Right? How do you know that? Oh, I looked at last year's budget last night, right? And I spent 15 minutes trolling around, and you know, how much did it cost for utilities, and how much does it cost for, you know, to have cars, right? I mean, cars cost money. Insurance, gas, repairs, right? How mm-hmm. much does that cost? Is it worth it? Don't know, right? Cars cost more than you think, right? Sometimes utilities cost less, right? Every time the electric bill comes and you know, the utilities, like, your efficient neighbors use, you know, only 1/3 as much electricity as you do. I'm like, I don't care. I mean, I know it'd be better for the environment if I use less, but all the computers that I have turned on, I want to have turned on. And the amount of money I spend per year on electricity pales in comparison to the money I waste having coffee and dining out. So I'm apparently willing to pay that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Closing thoughts?
All in all, like I said, I enjoyed it. It's very informational. I don't know that I'd ever recommend this book to someone. This isn't the book you recommend to someone to get their financial house in order. I don't think.
It takes the right type of person. This is not a put your financial house in order book.
Right.
But this is a, if you have somebody who's curious, and maybe doesn't understand anything at all about money, I think this is the book for them. Because I think if they get some book that's telling you do this and this and don't have lattes and, you know, do these other things and then you'll be rich, that's not what they're looking for, right? This is the type of book for a curious person who's looking for something that's interesting on a topic that they maybe know nothing about. And they can read it in bits and chunks. Like, there's not some narrative that you're going to lose the plot on. You can read two chapters and then set it down for a month and pick it back up again and have lost nothing about what's going on. But you'll learn something. You'll take away something interesting from it. And from there, I think the right curious person could go on to other books. If people really want to get their financial house in order and they want one book to do it, this is not the book I recommend.
I do think it's inspirational in the sense that if you thought, due to your station in life, your career, it's impossible for you to ever amass any sort of wealth, I think this book...
It clearly disproves that.
Yes. It makes it very clear that it is possible for anyone. Maybe not necessarily to become a millionaire, but to get better at accumulating wealth.
Oh, yeah.
So.
I think if you're young enough, almost anybody can be a millionaire, I think. Compound interest, my friend. Or plastics.
Yeah.
One of those two things.
The other thing I have to say, I do think it feels a little dated. Just a lot of the references, even the references about vehicles.
Yeah.
They were talking about one of the most popular vehicles being a Ford F-150 and the average price being like $22,000 or something like that.
Which is clearly not true anymore.
As someone who has recently shopped for a new Ford F-150, I mean,
yeah,
it's a much more expensive vehicle. They were talking about people driving, Ford Explorers and trucks and SUVs and those being sensible vehicles. I don't know if that's really the case anymore. A lot of the stuff too, I think it's still applicable, but it just felt like a very late 90s type scenarios.
Yeah, so some of the specific references are dated. The ideas and the encapsulated wisdom from the data are timeless. Yeah.
Exactly.
So... All right.
Yeah. Well, all in all, glad I read it. And maybe make some positive change because of it.
Are we going to read another book about money? Do you want to read another book about money?
I don't know.
Not going to commit to it on a podcast, that's for sure.
I think that I would be better off to invest some time in doing some budgeting and planning activities, rather than spending that time reading another book. Because I feel like I know where to get started and what I need to do.
Okay.
Go from there.
You're committed.
All right.
Talk to you later.